This videotape is edited from an advanced NLP training in Boulder, Colorado, April 1989. Many of the participants had also attended previous advanced training with Richard. Richard considers this seminar to be his best ever presentation of how he works with clients. Although he presents some new submodality methods, his major emphasis is on how he puts things together and the methods that he uses to create lasting change. Since this is a carefully sequenced seminar, we recommend viewing the videotapes in order.
The thing about listening to the presuppositions in what people say is first just the syntactic presuppositions, but then there's a meta level of presuppositions which has to do with understanding their presuppositions about time, and their presuppositions especially about causal relationships. Because it's a double-edged sword when you hear that people believe that if this happens, it makes you be a certain way. Well, then if you change what happened, then it's going to make them be different. And a lot of the techniques that I use now are about going back and putting different things in timelines. For example, I don't know, did I do the thing where you go back and build a new imprint experience? You guys know about that?
Some of you are saying yes. This is such a coherent group.
Well, anyway, we don't have to do it, but let me describe in essence what it was so I can use that. Is that one of the things is that imprint experiences themselves, a lot of times that people, you know, would say that, for example, I had a guy that had almost drowned when he was a kid. And what had happened was, he was young and he was on an inner tube, and it was on where a river is dammed up. And, you know, it has a spillway that went down. It's one of these little places in the middle of nowhere. And apparently, you know, his father was playing with him and some kids and had them on little inner tubes. And he kind of dripped it off, and his father was talking to somebody. And the more he yelled, the further off. And finally he went. And when what was stuck in his mind was seeing his father turn around and suddenly just freak. The expression on his face was that he knew. He didn't, like, realize that things were that bad till he saw the expression on his father's face and realized his father was too far away as his face disappeared over the spillway. And then, of course, suddenly the speed changed that he was moving as he rushed down the speedway, and it scared the hell out of him. Now, and he claims, you know, he almost drowned and everybody went and saved him or whatever. And after that, he was so afraid of, this is one of my great clients, he was so afraid of water, he wouldn't drink it. Now, I think that constitutes a phobia, right? He only washed with a sponge, right? And if you think about it, you're never going to be really clean that way. So he had to wash himself with alcohol after he sponge bath. Yeah! You know, that's no way. Nobody should have to live like that or smell that way. You have to fix a client like that because you're not going to sweat a sea of more than once, believe me. It's the only time I've had a client come in and I took a bottle of cologne out of my bag and went, now, what was your problem? But I mean, the thing is to him, one of the things that I did was to find out that this particular imprint was burned in his mind. And even the sound of running water or rushing water was enough to trigger it off. So it was not just a visual thing, it was also an auditory phobia as well. He couldn't walk in the bathroom when his girlfriend was taking a shower. And he couldn't flush the toilet for himself. And that doesn't even sound the same, but he knew it was water, any sound that he knew water could make. And, of course, this made rain a terrifying thing for him. He couldn't go out in the rain, you know. And, I mean, this, of course, is going to cut down, you know, the number of jobs you can hold down, too. You know, and, of course, well, of course, he lived in Arizona, but you know, that I don't think was entirely his choice. You know, I mean, you know, he'd have to live in the desert, you know, but it rains in the desert sometimes. And, I mean, you know... Because when I saw him, his girlfriend was there, and she had a great sense of humor, because she was kind of a okie, and she would go, yeah, when it rains, boy, he's down on the floor under the bed with the dog shaking like a leaf. She said, you know, it's embarrassing if other people are there and it starts to rain. She says, I just throw a blanket on him and tell people to ignore him. He'll be all right in a while. Well, you get used to these things after a while. You stop laughing at them and just throw a blanket over them. And you don't pay any attention to him. It'll stop raining pretty soon. And I'm sure there are people sitting in their living room going, right. Mm-hmm. But see, the one thing I wanted to do was is to take the very process that he was so convinced of. His presupposition of everything he said was, the presupposition was, is that it was the rain's fault, and that it was the experiences that made him this way. He, you know, because, I mean, he wanted to tell me all about this experience, and I really don't want to hear it. I don't give a damn what happened to people that much. Really, the only thing I need to know is how to utilize it. And as he kept wanting to describe, because he wanted to describe it in detail, and as he'd go back and describe it, you could watch him, you know, he'd be like flying through the first part of it till he hit that point at the edge of the falls where he said, you know, he could just see, you know, the top, all the way up till he could only see the top of his father's head, you know, this face of fear. And as he'd describe it, he'd even lift his hands up like that. And when his hands would be up, he'd be terrified. When he lowered them down, he'd be fine. It was kind of like that thing people do with their face, you know, that thing. And... Well, you know, clients are pretty amusing. You know, when the weirder they get, the more fun they are, actually. I like the weird ones because, you know, they come in and they tell you the strangest shit, you know. And they always demonstrate it for you. But the one thing I wanted to be able to do was to take the same presupposition. And this is where that technique came from that I taught. What I did is I went in and got the submodalities of the imprint experience. You know, the larger than life, because it was a picture, it was larger than life. It had an intensity to the color that was more intense than everything. And it was three-dimensional, whereas his other images weren't. So I took all the submodalities and went back, and I had him build an experience first. But I had him build a two-dimensional and flat, an experience that would convince him that when he turned his certain age, the phobia would disappear. And he'd fall in love with music, with, you know, something that happened, you know, something that his father said, you know, that, you know, or... something that would build the belief that when he turned his present age, this would entirely turn itself around, that he would suddenly fall in love with water and the sound of running water and the feeling of water flowing on his body and stuff, that what experience could occur that would be as cataclysmic that would convince him that he would have this problem, but when he turned whatever his age is now. Now, one of the things that made me think of it is he was about to have his 40th birthday. So he had actually said that coming to see me was his present to himself for his birthday. I mean, if I'm going to buy a present for myself, it wouldn't be therapy, I'll tell you that. What do you want for your birthday? Oh, I want to go relive some old traumas, you know. It's exciting. But so I decided to make it so that, you know, on his 40th birthday, all of it would change, since it was his 40th birthday. So what I did is I went back and I put back in his history. First I put back a new imprint experience that said when he turned 40, all of this would change automatically. Then the other thing I did is I went back and screwed up the submodalities in the other imprint experience and used something akin to the decision destroyer to do it. So that basically we went back before the experience, went right up through and blew the submodalities out. Because since his presupposition was, since I remember this dramatic experience, I'm stuck this way. So, of course, I screwed it up because I believed his presupposition. Now, as soon as you accept the presuppositions that people have, it allows you to work with them. And then sometimes you want to literally alter the presuppositions. For example, that life is always going to get worse. Some people, they hear them, the older you get, you know, the harder it gets. Stuff like that. You know, you can't teach old dogs new tricks. You should have told my dog that. He learned new tricks that I didn't even want him to know. It's the only dog I know that could open a jar of peanut butter, lick it out, and put the lid back on. It's nothing like opening a jar of peanut butter and there's dog tongue things on there. And you go, who put the lid back on this? And the dog goes, wasn't me. Can't believe the things. He learned to open glass sliding doors, go out, get in the garbage, go back inside and slide the door and hit the lock. Right? And then when I'd come into the house, he'd bark out the door. Right? So I'd go running out there trying to find out who was messing up the garbage. Well, one day I fell asleep on the couch and he didn't know it and I caught him. I watched the whole thing in the mirror up on the mantelpiece, right? Had this whole thing set up. When he was all done, you know, then he just sits and waits. And as soon as he heard me get up, he started barking ferociously. And I went, there's nobody out there. You got caught. And it was like, I have to come up with a new one. And he did. So I know you can teach old dogs new tricks. If he was 16 making this stuff up, it's not impossible. Now, by going back and building new imprint experiences, I'm accepting his world. Now, once it worked with him, I decided, well, if it works with him, we can try it with everybody. I mean, it's where I've gotten most of the best techniques, is from what the clients actually do. Because what works in them to produce a negative effect will work to produce a positive effect. It's one of the reasons, you know, that I stress listening to how people pull off their problems. Because, you know, if you think about now, like the thing we've been working with, the one thing, like the idea of doing it again probably seems like a lot of trouble, doesn't it? When you think back, you know, it's like going back to the old way seems like work now, doesn't it? Well, it always was. It's just that you were good at it, that's all. And you forgot you were working that hard at having your problem. You know, like if there's something that you're afraid of, right, you have to remind yourself. You can't just forget you're afraid of it, you know. It's like some people are afraid to, I had a client that was afraid to go places by themselves. And I mean, I'm not talking like walking down dark alleys. We're talking shopping malls, anywhere. I mean, for them to go anywhere, if they went any place by themselves, just driving to work, they were afraid, you know. And they do things like driving down the road. They'd make pictures of people driving by in another car and shooting them or pulling them off the road and raping them and stuff like this while they were driving. So I started asking, I said, how many pictures do you actually make in your head between your house and the office? And a person said, like, hundreds. And I went, hundreds? Right? And they went, oh, yeah, at least 100. You know, and I said, are they just slides or are they whole movies? And they went, well, you know, of course, you know, they're each one, you know, is like, you know, 3 or 4 minutes in length. And I thought, God, you know, I said, this is a lot of work. I said, you're a pretty creative guy, you know, being able to come up with all this stuff. And, you know, because what he hadn't thought of is the amount of energy that he put into it. And, see, the presupposition is that somehow or other this is going to prepare you for it. And the truth is he'd be more apt to get in trouble because he'd be so busy making all of these pictures, he wouldn't notice if somebody was breaking into his car. And if he did, he'd be so terrified that he wouldn't have any way of responding. Because especially in his scenarios, he always got killed. I mean, if you're gonna construct possible futures and you get killed in all of them, this is not what I call adequate planning. It's the old thing, you know. And I asked one time in a group for people to come up with something where they picked their worst fear and then came up with a scenario where it never bothered them again, right? And everybody came back and I asked people about it individually. And I asked this one guy and I said, how did you deal with it? And he goes, well, I got killed. And I thought, well, that's a choice. I said, it's not the first one that comes to my mind, but to him, it was the only way he could never have to deal with it again, was to get killed. You know, he ran into the situation, and somebody shot him, and he died. And I kind of recommended that perhaps there might be other choices, that it might be more advantageous for him to, like, do something about it. And in that situation, it was just that somebody threatening him in a bar or something, you know, somebody coming up and going, you know, fuck you, buddy. And so he just jumped back and shot himself. Ha, 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 that'll show him. Stick the gun in the other guy's hand and pull the trigger. That way he goes to jail, too. Try to explain that to a judge. But you go, the guy just stuck the gun in my hand and pulled the trigger. Right, sure he did. Go to jail. Do not pass go. Shows you being an asshole could be dangerous. You never know what wimps are out there. That's the basic kinds of stuff that I'm listening for. I'm listening for the presuppositions, especially about causal relationships, because they're going to tell me ways to change people. I want to hear their presuppositions about time. And also, I'm going to listen for sorting principles, the presuppositions about how the world is organized. Because I want to know how to utilize natural processes to get people out on the highway. So, you know, I mean, because I'm always trying to go get out there in the fast lane, put the fun meter to the red line, make sparks off the guardrail and scream holy murder while you do, you know. Make some noise, be alive, you know. It's if you really want to be polite and nice, make people feel good. Don't become invisible, you know. There's too many boring people in the world. You know, there's too much complacency, too much hesitation. I mean, when they did the study and they came up with the figure that 70% of the people in the U.S. consider themselves shy, that's a huge number of people in the U.S. You know, it's, you know what, close to 200 million people sitting around not saying anything. And, you know, try wanted things like hello. I mean, I'm always amazed in the flirting class when, you know, to these guys, you know, it's like, what do you do when you see a girl you want to meet, you know? And you know what they say? This is the kind of stuff I hear, the presuppositions. They go, well, I stop and I think to myself, you know, and from that point on, I know that the first thing they do is go on the inside. Hell, by the time they figure it out and open their eyes, she'll probably be gone. you know, and they all go, yeah, that happens sometimes, you know. You know, it's like I open my eyes and look, and she's not there anymore. And then they've been torturing themselves for half an hour for nothing. You know, they're going, well, if I go up, she'll reject me. She'll do this. You know, bad things will happen. You know, and I always say, you know, has it ever just dawned on you to just, like, say hello? And, you know, and they always go, you can do that? Yeah, you just walk up and you go, hello. My name is so-and-so. What is your name? And if they spit in your eye, move on to another person, right? At least you don't have to spend years worrying about it. And, I mean, the amount of time, it's like, even when people learn techniques like anchoring, when I first started teaching anchoring, people would, like, come up to me during breaks and they go, you, like, really do this with your clients? And I go, yeah. And they go, well, how do they react when you touch them? And I go, what do I care? That's their problem, not mine. You know, the reaction is usually however I've anchored them. You know, and they go, well, people go, don't you think it's odd? And I go, look, people are touching each other all the time. It's odd if you're behind a desk because then you have to jump over the top. That might take them off guard. But, you know, not if you do it consciously incorporated. And then, I mean, it's like when I started teaching sales, salesmen started telling me, well, you can't ask people about their internal states. You know, I mean, it's like, well, it's well and fine to do this stuff in therapy, but you can't ask people, you know, about, you know, submodalities and stuff in a sales situation. And I thought to myself, I didn't know that, and I've been doing it all these years. You know, because I do, you know, I go, I you literally ask people, I go, before I'm going to show you this, you know, sometimes you make good decisions. You know it's the right thing. People stop and they go, yeah. And I go, sometimes, you know, you make a decision and it's not the right one and you regret it. And they go, yeah. Or you know that, you know, it's you feel mixed and you don't think it's the right thing to do. And they go, yeah, I know what you mean. And I go, okay, here, I want to show you a brochure of a car. I'm going to put it up here. And, I mean, they'll show you with their eyes. And you can even ask them outright. I mean, I ask total strangers. People will tell you about their internal processes. They love to talk about it. In fact, once they discover that's a subject, clients don't talk about the past so much. You know, they go, well, I have this memory, you know, and it's big and it's bright and it's close, and it doesn't make me feel as good as I'd like it to, you know. You end up having conversations like that. You go, well, try this. It's hard to teach people to do covert work. And, I mean, especially for me, when I work with audiences, you know, I'm always doing what I'm talking about, and I'm doing a few other things on the side. I got to keep myself entertained, too. You know, I always have little hidden agendas, little things I want to stick in. But, I mean, you know, so it might look more like this, you know, while I'm looking this way. But, you know, and I like to set them up in aisles and rows and various things. But a lot of it's based on crystal ball gazing, too, because a lot of times as I'm mentioning things, again, I go through lists. Having taught as many seminars as I have and having known the kind of things that get in the way of people being able to teach NLP and to do NLP with a sense of humor and ferociously, I mean, it's like the exercise, the last one we did about exaggerating things, using humor to put clients and push them right up against the wall is, you know, I mean, I've done that. And if I don't adequately prepare people, when it's time to do the exercise, they're just afraid. Because, you know, they're going, well, I won't, you know, they start with, I can't do it as good as, you know, and they start, well, you know, I mean, I could have told them that, but that's why they paid money to learn about it, so they could do it better. When you start, people who sort by the person have really got a bad thing when they get into comparatives, because, I mean, I know of people that won't do things because they won't be able to do them as good as somebody else the first time, right? Which means they never get to start. Whereas if you compare whether you're getting better through time, then, you know, you can always improve. And, I mean, it's one of the best through-time strategies there are, is where you focus the grid to find out how much you're improving. Because if you improve this much and it makes you this much happier, imagine if you improve twice as much, how much better it'll feel. Imagine as you take the skills, just the stuff about that we've been doing about the overall packaging of working with a client, and as you take those skills, and because, you know, you've only done it once, now, unless some of you snuck off and did it last night. Yeah, there's a few of you here. Therapy junkies. Where can I find a client, man? I haven't worked with anybody in an hour. You look like you want to change, man. Got any problems? Ever feel like you hesitate in life? Well, there's this thing, if you just close your eyes now, that you might find useful. Well, anyway. Yeah. It's possible I may demonstrate
on someone in the target zone. And you know who you were, but you don't know who you'll be, and that's the good part about it. When you start making life more fun, and you start making your work more fun, and, you know, drop all this serious stuff, you know, as much as you can, because curing seriousness is where it's at. See, I mean, that's one of the things, like, with the threshold pattern. One of the things I like about threshold pattern is to sort between what's serious and what's worthwhile. You see, if it's worthwhile, it's worth enjoying. And this isn't a set of some modalities that a lot of people have, that things that are worthwhile engaging in feel real good. It's like a new kind of seriousness. I mean, I can work for hours and hours and hours on things because I enjoy it. That, I mean, even making these tapes, you know, that when they asked me to do it, the way they described it made it sound horrible, right? It's like the first time they came and asked me to do it, they said, well, we want you to do a really basic induction, one that anybody can respond to, that's general about everything. We don't want you to get real sophisticated and use a lot of fancy stuff. Just make it real simple, and we want it to be 45 minutes long. Right? And I went, oh, no, you know. And then I stopped and I thought, well, what could I do that would make it fun and make it worthwhile? How can I make it so it has juice? And I thought, music. Aha! So then I sat down on the piano and began to play. And then I thought, now, if I had a voice coming from here, the voice coming from here, and counterpoint in the voices that related to the music, this could be fun. It could be deepening and deepening. And I started playing that piano lick, ring. And as I started going it, I started to turn it in, because to me, for it to be worthwhile, it must be enjoyable. Otherwise, I don't want to have anything to do with it. Now, being able to build that kind of framework, as opposed to, a lot of people think worthwhile and seriousness, and they've got seriousness mixed up with just feeling bad, you know. Because, I mean, I have people in workshops that who are much too serious that say to me things like, they go, well, I really have a serious question you want to ask, and I don't want you to make a joke out of this. And, I mean, that's like painting a target on you and handing me a squirt gun, man. You know, that's just asking for it. That's all there is to it. And I go, oh, okay, I'll be serious. Right. You know, go ahead, ask the question. That, to me, that one of the things is one of the techniques sometimes I do with clients is I find a set of submodalities and dissemble them and reassemble the actual submodalities, because it's not that the things that they're serious about aren't worthwhile. It's that feeling serious stops them from doing anything about it. It's just like, you know, when we studied strategies in NLP, you know how some strategies are just useless? Well, some sets of submodalities are just useless. And, you know, to be real serious and grim about something is not helpful. That, I mean, one of the things that I noticed, I was babysitting somebody's 5-year-old kid, and you know how 5-year-old kids are. When they come over to babysit, the first thing they do is hurt themselves. You know, I mean, that's like, to make you look like a bad babysitter. It's sitting there, let's find a set of stairs, I can fly! Right? So, first thing, this kid did it before his parents even left. You know, he found a sharp object and cut himself. You know, it's like, oh, he thought his parents had left. That's what he said. He thought his parents had left. He didn't know they were still there, but they were only out in the driveway. So, one of those things, you know, jump the gun there. Told me next time he wouldn't hurt himself until after they came back. But he cut himself, and so he needed a few stitches. But his parents were so serious about it, they scared the hell out of him, you know. And, I mean, I literally slapped him across the face, just both of them at once. It's like a, you know, one of these Three Stooges movies. I said, knock it off, you're scaring the poor kid. I said, stitches aren't any big deal, you know. I said, you know, and I said, you know, I said, did your mother get all upset when she sews a tear in your shirt? And the kid went, yeah, right? And I said, well, aren't you glad you're not a shirt, you're a person? And he went, yeah, I guess so, you know. And I said, the thing that you got to watch, though, and you have to watch this very carefully, is that you have to watch to make sure that it doesn't hurt when they do it. And he went, I have to watch to make sure it doesn't hurt? And I said, yeah, you do. I said, because you see, if you look just close enough, in just the right way, and hold your hand just right, then what will happen is all the feeling will drain down your arm, and you won't be able to feel a thing, and that way it will heal 10 times as fast. Isn't that ridiculous? And he started laughing. He goes, nah, you're just making this up.
And I go, there's only one way to find out. I said, if you do it my way, it's painless. If you do it your way, it hurts. Now, which one of us is smart? Which one is stupid? Now, by making it, see, I'm still serious about the thing about getting it sewed up, but I'm not going to make it scary. And I think a lot of times, like especially around colleges, there's a lot of this going around. People think that really good scientists, like, you know, in the movies, you always see the really top-notch scientists. They have the white lab jackets on, and they're always very serious people. Well, every lab I've ever been in, they're the biggest bunch of joking wackos you'd ever want to meet. And I've been in all the top R&D companies in the world. You know, I mean, they're the guys in there late at night, you know, fuddling with things, you know, lighting their cigarettes off of lasers and, you know, figuring out how to see through cards so they can play poker. Well, if you put the right hue of light behind it, you can cheat at cards and stuff. I mean, these are people that live in Toyland. I mean, you know, research and development, I mean, there's no bigger Toyland in the world than a research lab. Somebody gives you $20 million worth of toys, tells you to figure something out, right? And there's a hell of a good job. These aren't serious people, but they're always portrayed because it's as if you're going to accomplish more by being grim. And it's not. How do children learn new things? By playing. And it's the playfulness quality that's missing in a lot of people. Now, one of the ways of ungluing and making change in large areas is to be able to dissemble four-tuple sets. Now, the sets of submodalities that constitute, see, like there was a time, you remember, Connie Ray, when you were in that strange place down there in New Orleans? Do you remember I did the section on dissembling your reality strategy? Right? Well, what I was teaching people, well, I was trying to teach them about assembling reality strategies. And the trick was, is I had people literally go through and dissemble their reality strategy so that their knowledge of what really happened, what didn't really happen, became like, I don't know. But then you can stick things in and put it back together. At least most people did. Some didn't, some did. See, now that we have a more sophisticated technology, there's some things that are similar to that that we can do. Because now what we can do is we can take sets of experiences that cause us to respond in a similar way that's not useful. And to me, seriousness is not useful. So we'll just use that as an example. But there are all kinds of other things. There are sets of things that upset people. I mean, and they upset them, you know, and there will be like whole classes of things that your husband or wife can do that would upset you, that in and of themselves aren't meaningful. But they're symbols. That's where you'll hear the word. And what they are is they're a set of four tuples that just make you feel that way. You can think of them as symbols. It's just out of your control for whatever reason. And the reason isn't important, but if you can dissemble and build in a new one which is more useful. Now, the dissembly process goes like this. You want to volunteer for this? I don't know why that crossed my mind, but so you don't have to tell us what it is, but pick something like in your work, like when you're using these materials and doing NLP, do you find yourself getting too serious, especially about the right way to do things and that kind of stuff? Yeah. Okay, now pick a particular type of client that you find you're much too serious with. You don't use enough playfulness with. Or particular other kinds of relationships you might have. Okay. Boom! Go down the list. Clients, relatives, friends, lovers! It's always easy to get too serious about that kind of stuff. Because after all, there is a right way to have a relationship, isn't there? You don't love somebody for how they are, but how you can make them. I love you the way you're going to be. When I get finished with you, you'll be perfect, or I'll leave you. Because sometimes we decide what we want is not what we desired. Now, okay, what I want you to do is to stop and think of the last time you were in the context where you were too serious. See what you saw at the time. Put yourself back inside it. And notice for yourself, where do you think that image might be? Okay, is it real life size?
It's about...
This is something 60. Worth being serious about, right?
Well, no.
Not now, huh? Boy, girls, you could make a lot out of this one. He's changeable. No, I'm serious. Go back. I love this one, boy. You can have a
go
lot.
Go back there.
Go back. No, back there. There's nothing to be afraid of yet. As long as you do what I say, you will be happier, healthier, and more virile. You interested in that?
Yeah.
If you walk back over there, every step will lead to impotency. Shortness of breath. I'm glad you've decided to go along with me on this. Feel good. Close your eyes. That's right. Just shut your eyes for a minute. Right? And stop and go back and think about something in your relationship you're too serious about. Even though when you look at it, you feel serious. Go back and look at something that happened that you felt was worth having an all-night discussion about. You remember those, don't you? The long, meaningful discussions where the discussion is longer than whatever the activity is you're discussing. This is the way I weigh it. If it takes longer to talk about it, then do it. It's not worth talking about. That's my criterion. And I have a little voice inside my head that asks, says, wouldn't you rather be fucking? It's how I keep things in perspective. And then that voice moves down here and other places. Okay, but you go back and look at the serious. Now, I want you to look. You know enough about submodalities that you know how big it is. You see the size of it? The distance? Okay. Now, this is serious, right? Okay. Now, well, hey, look, we got it. Okay. Now, what I want you to do is to think of something else that's that serious and notice that the submodalities are in the same place. Same distance, same size, same vividness. Or not. Is it a movie or a slide? Notice the sound, the internal tone of voice that goes with it. That self-righteous internal dialogue. Okay, notice the direction it comes from. Now, okay, once you've... now, you can't laugh. That's not serious. Don't laugh. I always love doing that to kids. Don't smile. That's right. Now, what we want to do is we now want to begin to take that and to alter it. So take one example now, and what I want you to do is, you notice, is the image, how big would you say it is, roughly?
About 6 feet.
By 6 feet? Is it square?
Kind of hazy. So.
What you're serious about is hazy? Well, as long as it's hazy,
and the edges.
Oh, just the edges are hazy. Okay, what I want you to do is, how about the top two top corners? Can you see where they are? Corners on the top? Or is it hazy there too?
No, there's other different things there.
Different things? Like handles and stuff? Is there a pair of rabbit ears or something? That's good. I tell you what you do. Go up and pull each corner up into a rabbit ear. Okay? All right. And then put a bunny nose on the front. Right? I'm serious.
You're serious.
I'm as serious as you're going to be. No, I'm telling you. This is pure science, man. What? You got it there? Okay, close your eyes again, because I want this real vivid, right? Take the part that's fuzzy around the edge and just make it a little white fur, right? Have it kind of twist a little bit at the bottom so you can see a little bunny tail, and then put two nice little rabbit feet out there, right? Then, you know that serious internal dialogue you have? Put it in Bugs Bunny's tonality and have it say the same thing. And then, know that you can deal with this serious, but
then,
okay, you can open your eyes if you feel better.
Okay.
It's I don't want you to attach these feelings to these people yet.
They're closed, okay.
They are closed now. It's either that or I have this desire to stick something in them, too. Now, at least he had an intelligent response. You know, I like what most people do is they open their eyes to see what it is. What are you going to stick in there? It's like, don't taste this. It's terrible. People always stick their finger in it and go like this. You go, here, this is awful. Try it. Now, okay, you got the Bugs Bunny voice? Okay. Now, you've turned the shape of this into a bunny rabbit, right? Okay. Then what I want you to do is to take a voice that comes from both sides here from behind, and I want it to come up from this direction, and I want it to be incredibly sexy and say to you, would you rather be fucking? If this is a relationship person, if it's with a client, I don't want you to ask that question. You have to have an MD to do that. Now, how serious do you feel about this particular content now?
Not. I'm just nervous being up here.
I would too. You'd be even more nervous if you don't do what I say. Stop being nervous or I'll hurt you. This is what I did to my stepson one time. He had a fear of water. He was afraid to swim. So I towed him out in the middle of the pool, and I said, relax or I'll dunk you. And he went and just relaxed comfortably. He'll be all right. He'll live through this. Now, go back and look at the event. Do you feel as serious? Now, stop and think of the time you've been the most playful. Stop and think of what the most playful thing you've ever done is. Okay? Now, what I want you to do is I want you to take the bunny rabbit and I want you to just pull it over and stick it right in front of that. And as it hits, I want it to melt right in to the other set of submodalities and spread out so that the content of what you were serious about, you're now playful, but keep the bunny ears. All serious things should have bunny ears. Now, when you think about it, does it seem as serious?
Which? That over there?
Well, you're supposed to pull that over there, the bunny rabbit, you're supposed to pull up, right? This
it's
is the
over here. Yeah.
Yeah, but pull it up and put it so that, like, if you take the picture of your playfulness, think of it as almost being water. Put the bunny rabbit right in so it melts in, and as it melts, take the content of what you were serious about, put it in the submodalities of playfulness, but add bunny ears to it. It's a normal thing everyone does.
Okay.
You got it? Now, are you as serious about it?
No.
Okay. Now, I want you to go back and look at something else that you're serious about. And as soon as you do, put bunny rabbit ears on it and repeat the process.
Okay. It's done.
Now, do another one. Now do being up here.
Jeez.
Mr. Slack here, huh? Do it, try. Being up here is serious, right?
No, it's just nervous.
Well, I mean, it really matters where you sit in the room. Would you rather stand next to me or in front of me? I think it's more dangerous over there, if you ask me. See, my philosophy of life is you can stand beside me or you can stand in front of me. Which do you want?
Here's fine.
Okay, now go up and put being up here as a serious thing. It's worth worrying about. Seriously, put up a picture that goes, it's worth worrying about being up here in front of all these people. It's real important. Listen to the internal dialogue that makes it a big deal. Notice what you're doing to yourself. And then make it into a bunny rabbit. Slam it over into playfulness. And then have a tonality up here and have it say, wouldn't you rather be teasing them?
Yeah, I would.
Aren't you going to? But keep the voice up there. Make suggestions. Look out, man. See, one of the things about being in front of an audience is that you get to watch them all at the same time. That gives you more choices of people to pick on than they have. They never think about it that way. Right. Look at them holding their breath, waiting for you to say something. If you wait long enough, some of them will die.
Hi.
See, you're too nice. Me, I would have gone... Okay, you can go sit down now. Thank you. Not there! You know what happens to you if you sat there, for God's sake? You have to be careful which trance you sit in. Now, yeah.
I just feel compelled to comment that someday this pattern is going to be in a book, and people are going to read it and think, in order for this to work, it has to be a bunny rabbit.
Yeah, I know. That's why I'm going to stick with a bunny rabbit for the next year. There'll be heaps of people sitting around at a committee meeting somewhere right. saying, we heard that Richard is making it into a duck. He's lost his mind. We all know it must be a bunny rabbit. I know. Well, see, the duck is the other polarity. I know. I'm glad you commented on that because I really don't feel I should have to point out that it doesn't have to be a rabbit. What did it... But I know somebody somewhere is going to do that. They've done it with everything else I've developed because they're serious. And they're going to get serious about making it a rabbit, too. Seriousness must be a little bunny rabbit. And logic must be a little bird. Humans are strange creatures. But I'm glad you pointed that out because I know somebody in their notes goes, and then you turn it into a bunny rabbit. A question was probably on their mind, does it have to be a bunny rabbit? Because I'm, you know, because I get, do you have to anchor on the knee? And I go, well, let's see. Probably. I'm sure, especially if they're in committee meetings, they'll probably kick somebody out of an organization for using a duck, And then there'll be two organizations, the people that do ducks and the people that do bunny rabbits. And then they'll write journal articles back and forth discussing which is the real one, whether Richard really meant we should use a duck or a bunny rabbit. See, I mean, I've watched journal articles back and forth where people argue about my opinion, and I'm not one of them. And as I look at these things, I go, so I feel that way, huh? And I go, I can do that. And then I read the other one, I go, so I disagree with that. Yeah, I can do that too. But so what? No, actually it is important, though. I don't know if I can even do this. I love discussing these important issues. The thing that I try to do when I'm doing dissembling is as they describe what shape it is, I try to find a natural animal that will apply. Or depending upon what the subject matter is, sometimes I just use body parts or various other things that I discovered, that, for example, I worked with this guy I was telling you about. What I did is I had him take the things that he was being serious about, because he's being really serious with his wife about, really extraordinary things, like, which side the silverware was on the table, And, he felt that, that when she put the spoon on the wrong side when he brought his boss to dinner, that she was doing that to humiliate him, right? And she said she did it because she was in a hurry. Right? She just didn't realize, and he said, this is the third time you've done it, But, of course, then she got caught up in which was the right one because she didn't grow up knowing which ones were which, And then, she got the silverware right, but she put the water glasses in the wrong place, And she just did that to aggravate him. Well, what I did is I had him take the things that were serious, and I had him put them on his wife naked and notice where his eyes drifted to. Now, he could either, because he was one of these people that he didn't have a picture of what happened. He wrote it out. you know, a visual digital. These people have real exciting lives. Their internal dialogue is a teletype. They're really slow to talk to, too, because they always do this. And then they come back to speak to you, and they forgot what they read, you know, and stuff like that. But so I had him put it on, you know, take, because Sirius to him was it was a page, it was angled out this way. So I had him just cut it into a shape of a woman and then have it come to life as his wife. But I also had her standing in a lewd position while she did it, find out whether he felt like arguing with her and whether this was more important or whether he'd rather be fucking. Now, if you add internal dialogue, now, what I want you to do is I want you to instill an internal dialogue that says, wouldn't you rather be playful? Would you rather be playing? Would you rather be enjoying yourself? Or would you rather have this conversation? Now, because the thing is when you're doing NLP, your playfulness and getting people to play with their problems. One of the reasons I've taught you games, like most of you in here have learned the thing, you know, where you fill in for a day for people. You know, you're from the temporary mental health agency and you go in and you have their illness for a day. You guys have done that, right? I love this group is so incongruent. Normally a group goes yes or no, and then half of you are going no. But it is. It's the same thing I did with the lady on the film from the Marshall University tapes. I said, wouldn't it be nice to have a day off from your problems? You know, and who's going to say no to that? You know, no, I'm going to have my problems every day. And I said, you know, think of me as somebody from a temporary agency. And that my job, if you can tell me how to have your problem, then I'll do it and you don't have to. You know, I'll fill in for you and you can take a vacation for 2 weeks and you don't have to have your problem. You'll be free from it. And it's a way of getting people to describe their problem instead of as a difficulty, as a skill. Like, so with her, she had the psychotic episodes that people were late. So I said, well, you know, how do I know when to have them? And she said, well, you have to arrange ahead of time for people to meet you. Right? See, already it becomes an active process. And I go, okay, well, if I arrange for somebody to meet me at 4, if they're not there at 4, I feel fine. And she goes, she looks at me like with kind of utter disgust, like, well, it's not that simple. Right? And I said, well, what do you have to do? And she said, well, you have to think about something happening to them. And I said, well, I think about them going out and having an ice cream. And I feel fine. And she goes, nothing like that. She said, like horrible things, like them being in an accident. And I said, well, I can make a picture of them being in an accident. I still feel fine. And she said, well, of course, at first you do. And I said, well, what do you do then? And she said, well, then you get closer. And I said, well, where do you start out? She said, well, it's like I'm across the street. But then the later they are, the more I float over till I can get over and see the blood everywhere and the eyes hanging out. And it gets bigger and larger and larger and closer and closer. And I went, ah, it works. Now I can fill in. But you see, as somebody does that, that what happens is rather than it being a problem, it gets translated into a skill. It's, to me, the translation device from therapy to NLP. And especially if people have had too much therapy. And this lady had 16 years of therapy with this. I don't have a good enough memory to have a problem for 16 years. You know, I'm sure I just forget. And I mean, I've tried it with people. I've tried just hypnotizing them, giving them amnesia for their problem. And the only difficulty with it is that everybody around them argues with them about it. You know, I took this one guy who was a chain smoker, had emphysema, and I gave him amnesia for having ever smoked. Right? And of course, what happened is people were showing pictures of him to him with cigarettes, and he looked at him, he'd look at the picture and he'd go, I'm not smoking. Negative hallucination. But they spent all their time trying to insist that he still had the problem. So you'd either have to hypnotize the world or else you have to touch a lie, which is what I did, is tell him to tell other people that they were just doing that because that other people were really having a conspiracy against you to force you to have been a smoker. So you must agree with them. Now, the thing that we're going to try to do here is what we're going to try to do is dissemble seriousness in a way that makes it so you can be more playful. And, of course, what's the tool? The tool is to play with your submodalities of being serious. That's why we make shapes out of them. Bunny rabbits and ducks, naked women. But no dogs or cats. Don't ask me why, but you must not make dogs or cats. We'll leave this on the tape for posterity. That way, they'll be working this stuff out for years, won't they? I mean, I'm glad you have a sense of humor about that, because it's the stuff that I hear people arguing about and stuff in NLP. To begin with, this is all a hallucination that started with me and John, you know, being locked up in the hills with nothing to do. You know, it was raining and we couldn't go outside, right? And that's basically where this started. And, you know, it was we watched too much television, read too much science fiction, and didn't understand our limitations. It's what somebody at the university told us, is that we just didn't understand our limitations. And I looked at him and I went, you know, you're right. I don't understand them. I don't even like them. But I understand yours, and I don't like those either. Now, the trick is again, like, remember when we did the thing, the pendulum thing? The pendulum thing that we did where you were eliciting what you wanted them to move away from was the old behavior. And what you want them to move towards is a futuristic behavior. We're going to do the same thing this time. The same principle applies. You want to build in something that draws them towards a future of being more playful about the things that they are serious in. Now, we'll restrain ourselves in content here and utilize the same kind of a technique. I want you to use the same exaggeration techniques that you were using before, the same skills, because when you what I want you to do is to start, I'm going to actually, in a workshop, let you have some content. How's that for a first? Pretty good. You get to advanced levels. You get to do some content. I want you to ask the person that you're working with, and you can switch partners this time if you want. Probably getting tired of your partner. They got all these anchors all over them, and now you got to wipe them off. So if they change clothes, then you get to make new anchors. That's why you have to have your clients wear the same clothes as therapy every time. And they can't wash them either. Seriously. Now, what you want to be able to do is I want you to have them describe what they're too serious about with their clients, whatever kind of clients they have, whether they do sales training, whatever. Where do they find that they get hooked? Hooked is a term Virginia taught me. Virginia used the term hooked by when she was training family therapists, when they got hooked into content, when they got hooked into the family system, when they started believing that what one member in a family system did was worse than another, when they believed that one person really was a victim and the other was persecuting them, and as if it doesn't take two to play that game. You know, if the wife poisoned him, he wouldn't be able to do it anymore. I mean, if she did, you know, if she made him wrestle next to the bed one night and he woke up and she was sitting there with a straight razor next to his dick, he'd be a lot more polite after that. You know, there are ways of capturing people's attention. But, I mean, you know, if she lets him beat her up, you know, for 5 years, you know, it's not just him doing it, because these things work in systems. All it takes is the right tonality, and she can get him to hit her. You ever notice that? You know, I notice. Use a high, pitchy, whiny tonality and relentless jabber, you know, and pretty soon anybody will want to hit you. I mean, and, you know, I noticed that because I did a thing for a shelter for abused women. And, you know, I was in there 5 minutes, and I felt like slapping the shit out of them. You know, it's like, change your tone of voice, man. You want me to help you? Shut up or I'll smack you one. And I mean, they had the most horrid tonality. I mean, it was like, you know, five dental drills coming at you at one time. You know, and I really had to teach them, look, if this is the way you want men to treat you, keep talking this way. And it was, well, we shouldn't have to change the way we act, you know, in order to be treated right. And I said, maybe you shouldn't, but if you keep acting this way, you're going to get smacked by me. Now, do you want to be treated well or not? Do you want to be hit or do you want to be treated well? Which is it? And they always go, well, I guess we want to be treated well. I go, well, if once you start getting treated well, you might discover that it's better than you think. And all it requires is tonality. They go, but it wouldn't be really me. And I go, it will be after a while, believe me. When they start doing things to you that make you feel that way, your voice will come out that way real natural. Trust me. There are better relationships you can have with men than violence. Trust me, that is also the case. Now, when you have the person, have them describe where they get too hooked, where they start thinking about too much, or they start worrying about the right technique, or they start worrying about whatever it is. Whatever your partner finds that they get too serious, and all you have to do is have them think, you know, what's the part where people come in or you're in a session where when somebody says something or things start to go, you say to yourself, oh, shit. You know, that's a good indicator, because that usually what follows that is seriousness, or where you begin to get self-righteous about things. Now, if you really want to find out, ask them what they dislike about other neurolinguistic programmers. It'll come out there, too. Ask them if they've ever been to a committee meeting and what they talked about. It'll come out there, too. That as you find that, then what I want you to do is to compare the submodalities between what's really serious. And you have to be able to use that tone of voice, because, again, it's elicitation. So when you say serious, you must sound serious. And if you have to laugh, then you have to turn around and go back and do it again. So when you find out what's serious, then you want to compare it with playful. Because both of these things do not preclude getting it done. See, a lot of people, there's a difference between acting serious and being serious. I am quite serious about the work that I do, but I do it in a very playful way, because that's part of what makes it work. Acting serious and pompous doesn't help to get things done. It doesn't provide you the range of flexibility and behavior to even do it. It's like, you know, if there's a right way to see families, if there's a right way, if there's a right way to learn NLP, for example, if you must spend 2 weeks doing sensory acuity exercises, learning to squint to see minimal changes, and you can't laugh about that, you will never learn to utilize this technology. Now, I'm the one that started that. I finally dawned on me that it wasn't that useful. You know, learn to squint later on. You know, make the responses more exaggerated and you're better off. But also, at the time that I was doing that, I didn't have the tools to exaggerate responses. Now that we have submodalities, you can crank anything up. You don't need to spend 3 weeks doing sensory acuity. You need to spend 3 weeks learning to have the right attitude. And the attitude is one that maximizes playfulness. So once you have seriousness and playful, then what you do is you start to dissemble by taking not one but multiple cases of where they're serious and having them convert it into animal shapes, anything that's playful. So they start playing it and then melting it into playfulness. Because in essence, what we want to do is start knocking out. We want the natural response to seriousness to get to playful to get it done. Okay? Grab yourself a partner and try this. It's fun. And do it in trance. Might as well. We've been doing trance all day. Tell them to stop and think back to the music they heard in the tape they were listening to. And remember that soft and playful melody. As they do so, allow their eyes to close and enjoy the process of learning. Really learning about going into a trance. Now go do it. I wanted to once again find out if any other questions have come to mind. I was hoping a few things would roll out of your curiosity. I mean, we have another day left, and I'd like to be able to provide the kinds of things that you'd like to know about. I can always come up with entertaining things for us to do. I'm always into wanton and unadulterated forms of making life more ecstatic. I wanted, while I was here, to spend time talking about how you format what you do with the client. And I think we pretty much covered that you coerce them into getting better. That, you know, you make the way they live seem so utterly ridiculous and unfamiliar that it seems silly to not go out and live their life, you know, and not get on with it, you know. You know how many that people sit around and worry about asking for a raise rather than just keep asking? If you ask enough times, you're bound to catch somebody in the right mood. Plus, if you breathe at the same rate, if you walk in and you sit down, breathe at the same rate, blink at the same time, slowly begin to nod your head yes, and then ask. They'll find their head nodding yes. I've discovered this is useful for many things. Any other questions that come into your mind? Do you have one?
Back to time distortion.
All right, back. God, my time is rushing back. No, go ahead.
I tend to lose things, particularly expensive earrings. And it seems to me there ought to be a way to use time distortion when I'm putting them down or something so that I can find them.
Oh, they don't even fall off. You just hide them from yourself.
It's like, this is, I don't want to lose these. They're the ones I always lose. They're the ones I don't want to lose.
Sounds like you would. I don't want to lose these.
I'm in a place where I will remember.
Well, the thing is you want to build in an internal dialogue that goes, remember where you put these. and touch your ear and put a picture of where they are in your mind. Look down, make sure they're still there. Because memory is based, the whole problem people have with memory is they don't encode the memory. So you have to stop. You have to have a thing that when you pull the earring out, screams in your head, "Stop! Remember where you put these!" You know, and then you will. And at first it has to be very loud so you notice it. Because if you say, "Oh, no, I won't forget where they are," you know. So you got to literally sit down and program yourself to do it. And what you do when you want to learn a new behavior like this is you do it rotely. You know, put your earrings on, take them off, set them down, do it, look, wait 5 minutes, then see if you can get a picture of it in your head. Don't just look at where they are, get a picture, and then walk over to it and do it like 5 or 10 times, you know, 3 times a day, and you'll program yourself to do things. Repetition does work, but you don't need massive numbers of repetition. You just need a few where you take yourself through the process, and you'll learn to install a new strategy. I mean, I found out, like, with things with the spelling strategy, it's not enough to tell kids. You have to encode a few words with them. You encode 10 words a day for a week, and after that, they start encoding them by themselves, and it becomes a natural process for them. You know, the thing is when people tell me, well, you know, it's not like me to do this, you know, and I go, "Was you doing it, wasn't it?" And they go, "Yeah," and I go, "Well, it's like you now." Because, you know, when just because things are unfamiliar doesn't mean they're not you. It just means they're new. When you learned to ride a bicycle, it was quite unfamiliar. First time you had sex, it wasn't the same old thing, you know. You know, but it's still you doing it. And, you know, it will become more natural the more you do it and the more you encode and learn those processes. And more enjoyable if you do it right. Seriously. Yeah, what was your question?
When you do covert therapy, when you're up there, how do you know? How do you know what everybody's issues are?
I don't. I do crystal ball gazing to find out.
How are you reading?
What?
What are you reading?
Things like head nods like this. Facial explosions of color and stuff, you know. You know, really, it's really overt. You know, you have to understand. I've done this for so long that if I didn't do it, so you'd come up and ask me anyway. You know, I get to the point where you know I've just done it to understand. I've probably done more workshops than all the other NLP people put together numerically. I just work more than anyone else does, and part of it is because I like it more because I have more fun than they do. You know, I mean, a lot of my colleagues are just so damn serious, they don't have much fun. So teaching is really work. So they do a lot of workshops for a couple of years, and then they really start to taper off, you know. And, I mean, I've taken a break now and then, but mostly my workshops are a lot of fun. I have a good time. And so I've done a lot more. And through the years, I've gotten to notice certain things and that people come and ask me about them. And it's not just a thing that's for one person. There are, like, groups of things that dealing with. And there are things that if you just change in people, makes it easier for them to not just participate in their life, but to be able to do NLP. So I think of it as part of teaching, because part of teaching has to do with installing chains with the information. You have to have the right feelings behind the behaviors. It's because it's not information. It's not just the dispersion of information, but that information has to be a chain installed behind it. People need to have a strategy to be able to think about it. And that's one of the reasons that I go through and tell stories, is because rather than going through the same thing over and over again, I can tell the same story, but go through 5 different stories, content-wise, that are different, but the same chain is there, the same sequence is there, so that I can make it so that, because I don't want people to take this stuff and go out and do what, you know, because the first few years when I was teaching, I didn't do this, and I saw what the result was, and I didn't like it, so I had to do it better. See, to me, the trick is to become a better and better teacher. And, I mean, I can tell by the quality of work that people do. I mean, I've seen some videotapes. I mean, I get them all the time in the mail. And I can tell, you know, which year they learned by what I was doing. I mean, I can see the difference in their skill level. I mean, you can tell the difference between people that continue to learn. And it's funny. Some of my oldest students are the people that are still going to workshops. And they're some of the best, like Connie Ray and Steve. Jesus, what was the first year you guys went to a workshop? It's 1975 or 6 or something. 77? I mean, you know, what is that? It's 12 years ago, you know. And, you know, you're sitting here, you know, like this, you know. And, And you don't get into that thing that people get into. They're too good to do the exercises. I mean, well, now that I've become a trainer, I don't need to learn anymore. I'll just be a jerk. I got a piece of paper that says I can be one. You know, well, you know, I mean, to me, you know, my enthusiasm, there isn't anything I do to any of you that I haven't done to myself 100 times. I mean, you know, I'm a lot harder on me than I am on anybody else here, let me tell you. You know, the shit I do to my brain, and a lot of the stuff I do doesn't work, and I have to fix it. You know? I mean, I've been locked in my room for 3 days trying to put my head back together, going, boy, that was a bad idea. Don't ever do that again, you know. But I mean, to me, the brain is a plaything. I want to know what it can do, and once I find out, sometimes I don't want to do it anymore. But, you know, it's like somebody loaned me one of these JVC special effects generators, right, and a video camera, right. And, you know, and I had a VCR, you know, and I have this great big TV on the end of my bed. I don't go home very often, but when it's there, it's like going to the movies. It's a huge thing. And it's not even a projection one. It's a big slotted matrix, fancy Japanese prototype thing, you know. And it sits there, you know, and I get my face right in front of it. I lay with my head towards the end of the bed. So it's right there, you know, panoramic, you know. So if I watch a videotape, I'm there. You know, I got a bruise on my head from watching Raiders of the Lost Ark, and the boulder came down and hit me, you know. And, I mean, they gave me this thing, and I sat there, you know, and what I did is, you know, I just, you know, I created an image, right, on the screen, first with the camera, you know, made a picture of myself there, and then started doing all this stuff to it, right. And then what I do is I stopped, and I take things and do it in my head. And this was years ago. I used to do this Fabric of Reality seminar where I taught people how to twist submodalities. I didn't say they were submodalities, so nobody else knew. It's funny, if you don't give a name, people don't think about it. But I used to do things like have people take images, right, of things that they thought were, you know, real. And, you know, and then find out what we could do to them, you know. Like I used to have them take the pictures and have them corkscrew forward. Have them go panoramic and fall over. Had to give you a minute to get up from that one. Have them fall forward, right? You know, take a panoramic image of yourself being 10 times as sensual as you are now, the way you're bound to be sometime in the future, right? Then turn it around backwards and have it fall on you. And hear the sound of a brick falling down as it lands. And, we used to do stuff like that, just to find out what your brain will do. I mean, I don't think that, you know, I mean, it's like, I love the one where the person put, you know, the swish pad. I love swish patterns anyway. People come up with great ones. The person, you know, puts the thing they want to swish to on the surface of a swimming pool, jumps off the high dive, and as they go down, they get bigger, right? That way it becomes life-size, and there's no turning back. This is what we refer to. There's one thing about jumping off of mountains, jumping out of planes, and jumping off of high dives. This is what we refer to as a real commitment, right? I mean, I had a skydiver. I had a guy who was a skydiver who told me he had trouble making commitments. And I thought, when I heard him say that to me, I thought, if there's anybody in the world that makes commitments, it's you, for God's sake. I said, what do you do when to step out of an airplane? You know? And he goes, well, I just do it. You know, and I said, sure. I said, I'm sure your body says, hey, no problem. Let's just step out of the plane. I know your neurology is going, this is wrong. There's no way your neurology looks out of the plane, goes 30,000 feet. Let's step. Right? I know every neuron inside of you has got to be going, well, we got a parachute. Blah, 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 blah. You know, there got to be some serious conversation. And he goes, well, yeah, I said, but, you know, he said, I make a picture of myself stepping out and I see the chute opening. Right, and then I jump behind it. So one of these days, see me, I'd be doing this stuff first. I saw that. Did you see that guy in San Diego? Did you hear about this guy in San Diego? He's a skydive photographer. He's the one that takes all the pictures of them, skydives down with them, right? He does 5 jumps one day, right? The last jump, he forgets to put his chute on. Now, this is what we call getting a little too visual, right? And you can see, they have the videotape. That's the only thing that survived, right? You see the videotapes going along, he's videotaping. For about 5-6 seconds, he's videotaping, and then it suddenly stops, and it goes like this. It goes like this, and then it goes like this. And then that's where he dropped it, I guess. But, I mean, this is what we're calling, you know, when people get locked into a lot of times, you know, they forget they exist. You know, I mean, I've seen this, you know, like I know you watch the TV, but these guys that always look through the thing, right, sometimes they forget. I mean, I've had, when they were doing the filming on the this one set that I was working on with a friend of mine who's a movie producer, the cameraman was doing this thing where he had to carry the camera, and he was doing his part, and then they had the ones on the trolleys and stuff. And when we broke for lunch, he was walking with the camera like this, right? And we said, you can put the camera down. And he went, oh, yeah. Walked over like this and then set it down. And to him, you know, he'd just become a part of it. And that's fine when you're talking about walking to lunch. But when you're talking about jumping out of an airplane, you should have some internal process that goes, wait a minute! You know, I mean, you should be able to feel whether there's a 25-pound thing on your back or not. But, I mean, this is where I want to have my kinesthetics highly tuned. You know, I mean, this guy couldn't make commitments. But, I mean, to me, you know, if you can jump out of an airplane, you should be able to translate that set of submodalities into, you know, jumping into something like a relationship. I mean, he was having trouble deciding whether or not he wanted to live with this woman. And so he'd get her all pumped up about it and tell her not to move in, thereby making her truly nuts. And then he said, well, she seems to get upset a lot, you know. And, right, I said, good, blame it on her, you know. That's right, go, let's move. You really want to live together? Yeah. Well, I don't know, you know. And then he'd wonder why she was kind of a yo-yo, I mean, as he put it. And I'd said, well, you know, if you're holding the string, you got nobody to blame but yourself. These kinds of things, I mean, the presuppositions that somebody is unable to do something when you can readily find examples in their life is one of the kinds of presuppositions that I hear. And they also, even when you mention it to them, they will talk as if that's different. And so that's where I have to break presuppositions. And breaking presuppositions is fun, because this is where exaggeration is your most powerful tool. This is where you can, I mean, if you remember the thing I did on the Shyness tape with this guy, you know, because I will not let up, you know, and they go, well, yes, but skiing is fun. Ski jumping is fun. And I went, jumping off of mountains is fun, and women is scary. And he went, well, yeah. And I just kept repeating it. And it's like sometimes it don't go through the first time, sometimes it don't go through the second time, but by the third time you see the fog begin to clear, right? It's, you know, it's just like looking at Andy and saying, people come off the TV and you watch the Playboy Channel or you watch Little House on the Prairie, right? Which makes sense. Even out of the waves of schizophrenia and the drugs that he took, you can watch the clouds part. You can watch that little glimmer where the eyes suddenly focus, and it goes, yeah, that makes sense, you know, that you can jump, that you're not afraid to jump off of a mountain on a pair of sticks, right, into God knows what, right, and walking across a room and saying hello scares you. Now, but, you know, and I mean, of course, I'm always anchoring these things, you know, in terms of, you know, well, if I thought about what was going to make me feel good, right, you know, throwing myself off a mountain, you know, meeting beautiful women. And as I kept on him in this way, I kept saying, think about it. You know, nice, soft, beautiful woman, hard, cold snow. Put sticks on feet, race downhill, and jump out. Fun, you know. Walk over, kiss and caress lovely woman. Scary. Now, they really need to learn to do this. It's different than sarcasm. It's really looking at them like, oh, yeah? You know, because sometimes you got to do it slow, got to do it a few times, and you keep kind of going back and forth till something in their brain cracks open and goes, that's stupid. Because as soon as you get that opening, boom! That's where you can slide in the suggestions. That's where you can go, take the picture in the submodality, put the woman over here, put the sticks over there. Try this on for a while.
you know, or put them both over here, you know, but for God's sake, don't keep the woman over there if you got the sticks over here, you know. I mean, you know, because, you know, as you know, because even with him, I go, right, you go out, spend money, buy sticks, buy all this uncomfortable clothing, right, get in your car, drive hundreds of miles, right, so you can go and stand in line, so you can sit in a chair to go way up a freezing mountainside, so you can get on the sticks, so you can not just slide down the hill, but jump 200 yards out into God knows what. Now, this is your idea of a hobby, right? The guy went, yeah. And then I said, and on the other hand, you're sitting in a room and you see a beautiful woman and you go, oh, God, I better not walk up and talk to her. Who knows? I might fall on the floor, you know. Break my nose, right? It's a lot more dangerous than jumping off of mountains. And it's a lot more trouble because you have to walk all the way across the room instead of just drive 200 miles. Makes sense, doesn't it? Now, when you start to present things in this way, what happens is it begins to build a little perspective in. Because one of the things you have to understand about the things that people can, that fit for them, primarily has to do with the angle. Like, if you take thinking about exaggerating things with clients in this way, if it feels unnatural, what I want you to try to do is, like, put an image of yourself doing it out in front of you, in space. Only make it three-dimensional. In fact, make it holographic so that literally you can move around it. Close your eyes and make it so that you can move all the way around, so that you could be from the point of view of behind the client looking at your face, and then keep moving. And what you'll notice is as you enter behind yourself, there will be a particular angle that you can step in easily. In fact, an angle where you almost get sucked in. Now, this is one of the things when people say, well, they can make changes if they look at it from the right perspective. Now, this kind of a perspective assists people. Now, one of the things is that in order to get people to be able to be receptive, it's not enough just to change the angle of the image. You want to make sure that it's connected with all of the emotions possible. And this is why where I use exaggeration is a powerful tool. With a guy like this guy who was shy, the more ludicrous I make it seem that, you know, well, if you can jump off a mountain and you can't walk across a room, you know, like, which is more dangerous? Let's think this over. Part of what I'm trying to do is instead of just, like, making submodality changes mechanically, I want them to have the full-blown emotions that go with them. That, you know, I want him the next time he gets up on that mountain to think about, you know, this is a little ludicrous, right? He can still enjoy it, but then when he gets down to the ski lodge, walking up to a woman is going to seem like nothing. And this is what I'm after, you know, because if he can jump off of mountains and then he has to hide in the ski lodge, that really is stupid. There's no other description for it. You know, I mean, if he's got the balls to jump off of a mountain, he ought to be able to at least walk up to somebody and say hello. It seems to me that it's the simple things that people have trouble doing, that they have trouble being nice to the person they live with, where they can be nice to total strangers. You know, I mean, to me, I think about it, you know, if I'm going to be shitty to somebody, pick a stranger. At least be nice to the people you live with. I mean, for no reason, you know, other than the fact that when they're smiling and happy, it's a lot nicer. Either that or close the door. And shut up, you know, because if you really anchor a lot of bad feelings to the people you live with, then when you walk in, those will all trigger off, and it's not very useful. Anyway, you come back here at 10 o'clock tomorrow, and think of the kinds of things that you'd like to do. We'll get into that more tomorrow. Remind me.